Senate Human Services Policy Committee together. And
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Okay.
You have Senate Bill 1 on your agenda. We first heard this last Thursday, at which time we heard from 21 people in multiple written testimonies. Today, we can start off with the list that we created on Thursday. Mm-hmm. You have a number of people remaining on that list. However, it's possible that not everybody will attend the meeting this afternoon. As you remember, Senate Bill 1 has to do with mental health parity. And Holly Robinson from Legislative Council is here to talk to us about possible Measure 13 impacts.
Welcome, Holly.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Holly Robinson from Legislative Council, and I've been asked whether or not our office has an opinion as to whether or not Senate Bill 1, which is a modification of a mandate, would be in violation of what's known as Measure 30, which is that provision of the Oregon Constitution dealing with not imposing local mandates. We're not imposing unfunded local mandates.
Okay.
It is the position of our office that this bill does not. I have been doing insurance drafting for the last two sessions and have not been asked this question before in relationship to an insurance mandate. It is our opinion that it is neither a program, as the words in Article 11, Section 15 is used, nor is it imposed on local government. So I do not believe that there is any reason to be concerned at this time about the possibility of being in violation of that measure.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? Okay. Seeing no questions. Thank you, Holly.
My pleasure.
Okay. The Health Policy Committee is in a subcommittee right now. We will be joined later by others, but I want to say that we want to hear all of the testimony. We don't know how many people are going to show up later, and so I would ask you to please be brief. If you have written testimony, please submit your written testimony. I would appreciate it if you would summarize your written testimony. If you have a compelling story to tell, tell your story. I don't want to cut people off. And I will. I won't. I just want to start by saying that we. I don't want to be here until 10 o'clock tonight, and I'm not sure how many people are going to show up later. We will have a quorum. I thought we would have one by now, but we will have one shortly. So we will start with Dr. David Pollack, Medic Director. And so, Dr. Pollack. Okay.
Chair Morissette and members of the committee. Now there are members. I'm David Pollack. I'm the medical director for the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services for the Department of Human Services, and I guess I'm representing the department in my testimony today. I'll try to be brief. You have written copies of my testimony available, I believe. Senate Bill 1 would correct the disparity that currently allows commercial insurance coverage for behavioral health conditions to be markedly less than for other medical conditions. Failure to provide medically necessary care for mental health and addictive disorders costs employers and the public much more than the cost of this care. Denial of such care makes no clinical or economic sense. The fiscal impact of this bill on the state's budget and on the private sector would be negligible. What I'd like you to do is consider some of the main points that I made in my testimony. I'll give you the headers, and if you have questions about some of them, I'd be glad to respond to them later on. I might embellish a couple of them as I go through, though. First of all, mental illness and chemical dependency problems are prevalent. We have a lot of data to demonstrate that. Secondly, mental illnesses and chemical dependency problems are costly, both in terms of the treatment costs and the indirect costs. The burden of disease studies that have been done by the World Health Organization and others have demonstrated that out of the 10 most expensive illnesses, 4 of them are mental health or chemical dependency problems, both in terms of the direct health care costs and the indirect costs. We have good and growing knowledge base in terms of psychiatric and chemical dependency disorders. We have a growing amount of research funding and the advances in that research. We find that treatment works, but that there are significant barriers to treatment that we think need to be addressed, and that this bill would help to do that. A piece of information that may be misunderstood, and certainly there's a lot of confusion about it, is that parity will actually contribute to the stabilization of some insurance market inequities that we currently experience. And there was a point that was raised by Senator Minnis at the tail end of the hearing on last week that I think bears attention. And that is, he was of the opinion that this bill would have no relation and no impact on the Oregon Health Plan. And the people who are on the Oregon Health Plan should be a very significant concern of the states, and why should we be concerned about commercial insurance and group health insurance? Well, the fact of the matter is that the lack of parity leads people who have commercial insurance coverage to end up exhausting that coverage, as Linda Riley and other stories reflected in last week's testimony, and putting those people not only into the position of having more suffering, but also exhausting whatever coverage they have, and causing them ultimately to go on to publicly funded insurance, like the Oregon Health Plan. By providing parity, there will be a reduction or a cessation of the kind of cost shifts that are associated with that kind of activity. Next main point, and Holly Robinson more or less endorsed or underscored that, parity really isn't a mandate. Medical necessity determination is still up to the healthcare provider or plan in this bill. This is a coverage issue, not a mandate. Insurance or health plan aversion to providing sufficient care for a select group of patients is in effect a pernicious form of discrimination. The costs of parity are less than opponents predict. You've heard from some folks that the predictions would be somewhere around 1% in terms of premium increase at the most. Depending on whether or not the plans are ones in which managed care has already been part of it, that cost could even be less. The predictions by others, including some that I heard from the insurance industry or from the business sector, that the costs would be upwards of 4 to 8 or 10% of increases are really not sustained in any studies that have been done elsewhere when parity has been implemented. And the arguments against parity are really based on what one consider fallacies. One argument has been that the diagnostic system in determining the kind of mental health or chemical dependency disorders are imprecise. They're as precise as they are for any other area of medicine. And that the treatment guidelines are not effective. They are effective. And in some cases, the concern that sometimes we're treating symptoms in certain conditions when we don't know for sure what the cause of the condition is also not a valid concern, because that's something that's done and is appropriate in other areas of medicine as well. As we gain knowledge, we learn more and more about the biochemical and genetic sources of some of these illnesses. But prior to that, we still have developed treatments that work. Another important point is that most other states have already implemented and adopted parity provisions. To correct something that was said last week in the hearing, I think the figure of 20 states, actually over 35 states, now have parity provisions, and none have replaced them, and some have expanded them. Oregon's reputation as an innovative pioneer in relation to social and health policy does not apply to insurance for persons with mental health and chemical dependency conditions, and I think that's sad. Finally, parity is a question of human rights. Our understanding of mental health and addictive illness has never been greater. These illnesses exact a terrible toll on patients and the economy. Based on scientific advances and effective treatments, it is time for Oregon to close the insurance gap for its citizens with mental health and chemical dependency conditions. There would probably be no appreciable costs or savings derived from this legislation. However, there would certainly be a reduction over time in the overwhelming demands placed on our public mental health delivery system that has suffered from many reductions. This would allow some patients to continue to receive treatment from the private sector and the providers in that private sector. The public sector could then more effectively implement preventive and earlier interventions for serious psychiatric disorders. I'd like to make one brief comment about the Dash 2 amendment, since it came late and we weren't prepared in our testimony to comment on that. In looking at it, I think there's relatively little concern about it. I think it's an acceptable substitute for the original bill. However, there is at least one provision, and we'll kind of reserve until we find out more about it endorsing that, and that is the expansion of the review by psychiatrists or other physicians and social workers and psychologists. The one concern we have is that we make sure that whoever's doing the review is doing it for things that are within the scope of expertise that he or she has. I believe that the references to the National Committee on Quality Assurance may clarify that, but we just aren't sure at this point, and the authors may help us with that. Okay. I'll be glad to answer any questions or respond to any concerns that you have.
Questions?
Just one, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Senator Walker.
Thank you. Mr. Pollack, I was reading your testimony, and under number 8, you said costs of parity are less than opponents predict. And within that, you say under current parity initiatives in other states, costs and premiums have either dropped or only increased slightly. Has someone prepared a matrix of those 35 other states to show that?
Yes. Through the offices that are related to managed care at the Center for Mental Health Services and the Center for Substance Abuse Treatment, that's part of SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, that's the federal agency within HHS, they have studied, and they actually have at their website data that probably is still pretty contemporary on the costs that have been incurred in terms of the parity provisions and initiatives in those states.
Okay, thanks.
And we can provide that for you if you want.
Senator Fisher, just have a comment and a question that I'm not going to require that you answer. I don't recall ever asking or working to do anything with any of the government agencies that they don't put a whale of a cost on, and yet you glibly come out here and say we can do this without basically any additional cost. Why can't you adapt those kind of things over to your agency when we have a bill that would increase some of the things you do?
Senator Morissette and Senator Fisher, I'm not sure I understand your question. I think if I understand it correctly, you're saying that I am somewhat glibly saying that there would be no cost in relation to this bill.
No particular cost increases.
No particular cost increases.
We say that about some of the bills that we do for the agencies, and you scream bloody murder.
I don't know how to respond to that. I think
I didn't think you would.
I think that what I'm saying is that this particular bill would have very little impact in terms of premium increase. We know it will have less than a 1% increase impact on premium, depending on how much managed care is implemented in relation to it. And we know that in most of the plans, managed care is already in place, so that the premium impact would probably be less than 1%. The reason we say there would be a negligible cost is that the ultimate impact of providing care to people that in a timely way, earlier interventions in the course of an illness, as opposed to delaying care, will mean less expensive care at the time the person is treated, and having that cost not shifted as much to the public sector. So that the coverage that people are purchasing, either by through their employer or through other group health programs, will be going towards the care that they need and will be getting done earlier in the course of an illness so that you can prevent more expensive consequences of those illnesses. I can give you some examples if you wish.
I understand all that. That's the same argument we use with the agencies, and somehow or another you don't read it the same when it's coming home to roost. I can think of numerous things that we've asked and give you evidence of those in times past, and it falls on rather deaf ears. We deal with it every, almost every committee meeting we have in the form of fiscal estimates of what it's going to cost the agencies to do all these bills. I would just give you one myself. I'd appreciate it if you could come over here and tell us what it costs you to add mental health to the Oregon Health Plan. We didn't have it at one time. We certainly haven't seen any savings in the Oregon Health Plan.
Well, Senator Morissette and Senator Fisher, I don't believe that the costs for providing services through the Oregon Health Plan, although I understand your concern, I don't believe that the provision of mental health and substance abuse services through the health plan has ended up being the reason, the main reason that the health plan has ended up costing so much.
No, it is. I agree with you on that. I think several other reasons that it cost, but it didn't come cheap.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Don't go away.
Don't go away?
No, don't go away. Lynn Hagen, Hager, would you... Hagen, did you want to respond to the Dash 2 amendments, that the question that he raised?
We talked before, Mr. Chair.
Well, why don't you come up here and tell us this? I mean, as long as you raised this question, I wanted to see if there was a response to your concern about the Dash 2s.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Leonard Hagen with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. I don't have an answer at this time. I'm going to have to go back and check. But like Dr. Pollack mentioned, I think the answer lies in the NCQA requirements as to the scope of practice and review. But I will follow up and get an answer back to the committee.
Okay. Dr. Pollack.
Senator Morissette, our only concern is if it isn't clear in the NCQA guidelines, we would want language in the bill that might clarify that people of different disciplines would not be asked to review the care of people whose work would be beyond the scope of their expertise.
Okay.
Agreed.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Bob Lightower, please. Would you,
John?
Pardon me.
John Lightower.
Okay. No, but it says Bob here, but that's okay. I have a mistake.
I've got a little written testimony.
Sure. Why don't you go ahead and give the written testimony to the clerk?
I make a mistake.
Angela Kimball, are you in the room? Elizabeth Beyer, could you... Angela? Yeah, why don't you come up and... Elizabeth, you want to come up and sit down and we'll go through these? Go ahead. John? Good.
Chairman Morissette and members of the committee, I want to say if I make a mistake, this is the first time I've ever testified in a hearing, so I want to say it's completely accidental if I make some...
Well, I made the first mistake by calling you Bob. So you're entitled to
feedback. Thank you. I also wanted to say this was not part of the written testimony, but it's coincidental. Dr. Pollack just testified that a person would leave a group health plan and go to the Oregon Health Plan because their insurance policy would not cover mental illness, and that is exactly what occurred to us. I had my daughter on a group plan, and I had to move her to the Oregon Health Plan in order to be covered. And you'll hear this in the story that I'm about to tell you. My name is John Lightower, and I live in West Lynn. I've been married for 38 years. I have two children, Richard and Annette. My daughter, Annette, got a mental condition. First, let me tell you my background. My family, both sides of my family, came here in Oregon in the 1870s and 1880s. My mother's side came over the Applegate Trail and homesteaded in Ashland. My father's side came to Oregon City, and he worked in the mill there in Oregon City. I have an MBA from Portland State University. I am a CPA. I was with Price Waterhouse. I was a CFO of a large restaurant chain in Oregon here. I developed a software product that became a company. We employed 45 employees in 1996. I sold it. I now have a small business in West Lynn. So I'm coming from the business side of this thing as well. My daughter is an honor student at St. Mary's Academy in Portland. She holds the school record in the track meet and is a state champion in the 440 relay. She's a graduate of Boston University. She's 29 years old. She's living at home with us, and she's unemployed. On March 14th, around 11 o'clock in the morning, an incident occurred which changed our lives forever. Annette was on prescribed medication. She hadn't taken her medication for about 4 days, and my wife tried to force her to take the medication. Annette pushed her. My wife fell down. Somebody, probably one of the neighbors, called 911 for medical attention. In Oregon, I guess, at least in Clackamas County, it's required to have police come if an ambulance is called with a mental illness. The police came, they arrested her, and took her to jail. All right. I pleaded with them to take her to a hospital, and they wouldn't do it. They refused. They said, this is a domestic abuse. She pushed your wife, and we have to charge her. They placed her under a $15,000 bail, and they put a restriction that where you can't come home because it's a domestic violence. I worked with a fellow named John Humphreys, who is the coordinator at Clackamas County Mental Health, to try to get her out of the hospital. Beds obviously are out of the jail and into a hospital. The beds are very difficult to find, but at 9:30 on that night, he called me at home. He said, good news, we got a bed at Emmanuel Hospital. I had to promise a head nurse on duty that I would wash her car on Sunday if she would work with us, and he did. So he said, but there's a problem. And I said, what's that? And he said, in order to admit her, you're going to have to come down and personally guarantee that you'll pay the hospital bills. And I said, I didn't think you could do that. I thought that was illegal. I thought they had to admit her. I said, we just won't find her a bed. And I said, well, she's got insurance. And he said, well, we can't tell. It's Health Net Group Insurance. He said, we can't tell if Health Net is covered for mental illness. Now, I had a choice. It's 9:30 at night. My daughter's in jail. Now, believe me, she's never done anything. She's not a violent girl. I have a choice. At 9:30 that night, I could pay her bail, and they would release her into the street because she couldn't come home. I could leave her in jail, or I could go down and sign that I would personally guarantee for those medical bills. Now, obviously, there was no question in my mind. I went down and signed for it. At about 1 o'clock that night or 12 o'clock, they brought her down and admitted her, and she stayed in the hospital for 15 days. The total bill was $15,000 for that. I was going to read this, I'm testifying for several reasons. First, it was my understanding that a personal guarantee for requiring admission to an emergency room hospital is illegal, but I had no choice. Secondly, mental illness can strike anybody. It can happen to any family. It can happen, according to the National Institute of Mental Health, 1 in 4 families are affected with mental illness. A person with group insurance in this world is not necessarily covered for this. 1 in 4 persons have mental illness, and they're not necessarily covered. So that's what I thought insurance was all about, is in case this catastrophe happens, and none of us know when one of our children or grandchildren will be affected by this. That's why I was buying insurance, because I thought I would be covered if something catastrophic would occur. Without proper insurance, that family could become bankrupt, or the mentally ill person, which is even worse, generally lives on their own at just a subsistence type level. A representative of the Chamber of Commerce in Bend testified last week that most of his 1,500 members of his organization opposed the bill. Well, at least 450 of those owners are affected with mental illness in their family. And 25% of all those employees in Bend are also affected. And you don't know which one's which, and they don't know when it's going to happen. But I'll tell you what, when you have to come up with $15,000 to pay for 2 weeks' worth of care because you can't be covered by insurance, is pays a lot of premiums. I believe it's irresponsible for any business to knowingly put their employees at financial risk and not to allow mental illness to have the same coverage as would be expected from diabetes, heart, cancer, or any other disease is negligent. I buy insurance in case I, a member of my family, have a medical crisis. I am sure that's the reason why everybody buys insurance. You can call it physical, you can call it mental. It really doesn't matter. It uses the same dollars, and without insurance, it will destroy a family. The people you represent depend upon you to make the decisions to protect them and their families from financial ruin. And this is not a place to put them into further risk. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Thank you. Question?
Yes. I have questions.
Okay.
Mr. Lightower, you testified that the hospitalization costs for your daughter were $15,000.
Yes.
Was covered by insurance?
Partially, and partially by the Oregon Health Plan, because we immediately got her on the Oregon Health Plan, and somehow, and I'm really not clear what happened here, it was retroactive back to that time. So, because what we found out was when I signed, obviously that night when I signed to her to be on this, that I then went the next day, well, Monday, it was on a Friday night, so Monday I went to the Oregon Health Plan and signed her up for the Oregon Health Plan.
And is your daughter taking her medication now and pretty good?
She is. Thank you. She, in fact, today she got a driver's license. She was in the hospital. She got released from the hospital. She was hospitalized again. Got out from OHSU. She was hospitalized from January until March, coincidentally, 14th of this year. And that hospitalization seems to have been really helpful. She's taking her medication today. She got her driver's license. So, yeah,
great.
We're on the right track.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. You can step down.
Chair Morissette and members of the committee, my name is Angela Kimball, and I'm actually speaking to you at the request of my youngest son, whose little 13-year-old nerves weren't quite up for coming to Salem and testifying in front of you, and mine aren't quite up for it either, but I'll do my best to try. When I explained, or when he overheard what I'm working on in terms of other families who are interested in parity, he wanted to tell his story. And here it is. My name is Jake Steckley. I'm here to tell you about the story of my brother and my dad and how treatment and medications changed my whole family's life. Ever since I was little, my brother had been going to psychologists. He was just really hard to deal with. He got mad at everything and made my life miserable. At first, my mom was going to counselors who couldn't help him. But then he went to a psychiatrist who said he had ADD and then bipolar. He helped him get the right medications. Some medications have been changed because they didn't work out, but now he pretty much has what he needs. But without Alex having medication, I probably wouldn't be here right now. My mom and I would probably be somewhere else without him because he was really scary until he got help. I didn't know what was wrong. Sometimes he'd be okay, and then he'd be really mad and all paranoid. And I worried about me and my mom, whether we'd be okay. Now he's okay, but with his medications, my mom has to pay a lot of money, and there are no more counselor visits on her insurance. But I know I can't live with him unless he has his meds. I'd run away. I know what he's like when he doesn't have them. I also want to tell you about my dad. When I was young, I never really knew my dad, who he really was, because he was always on drugs except for the times when he quit, but he always started again. He kept it really hidden, and he had a really good job. But we found out. My mom divorced him, and he moved away, and I think he started using a lot more. He lost his business, and he went crazy because he didn't have enough money to buy the drugs he wanted. And after he had destroyed almost everything, he decided he would go into treatment. But I know his insurance wouldn't cover it because he had already been in treatment a long time ago, and they wouldn't pay for it again. Now he owes the treatment place a lot of money, and my mom had to pay a deposit on her credit card when he went in because otherwise they wouldn't take him. I know it made her mad, but he's our dad, so she did it. I used to worry all the time that my dad was killing himself, and I didn't want to think about it, but it affected me. And I used to be embarrassed when kids asked me why my dad never picked me up. I felt like no one understood how bad it was to have a brother like Alex and a dad who was addicted. My dad's been working for a long time now on everything he knows today. He learned he has depression. He learned he has a disease. When he was in treatment a long time ago, they thought taking other medications was bad, so he never took anything for depression. And it made it really hard for him because he was dealing with two diseases. Now he's been clean for over a year, and I'm really proud of him. And now I'm not worried that he's killing himself anymore. And I'm starting to have a real dad. I think insurance should pay for things like my brother and my dad's problems because they affect the whole family. Thank you.
Thank you. Elizabeth?
I can, excuse me. Chair of the committee, members of the committee, I'm here in support of Senate Bill 1, representing the Mental Health Association of Oregon. Mental health parity, or the ability of anyone to receive mental health services at the same rate that the person is able to receive physical health services, is a key issue for the Mental Health Association of Oregon. We believe adamantly that mental health parity is critical to enhance Oregon's economy by allowing people who depend on mental health services to work because they know that their services would continue to be available to them whenever or to whatever extent the worker needed their services to be available to them. Workers could keep on working, paying taxes, and participating in their communities. Mental health parity is critical to support the families of insured workers. Insured workers must strain their resources and sometimes separate or lose their homes in order to maintain services for their ill family member who has reached their limit of benefits. And mental health parity is critical to reducing the pressure on public health and public safety services. Every time a worker or family member reaches their limit of benefits, the danger is always that their lack of resources will force one or all of these members of the family to go on public services. And we know that's another enormous cost shift. It is the cost shift that occurs when a person moves from a contributing member of society to a member on the needy rolls. Please support Senate Bill 1 to support Oregon's economy and the workers that make it strong. I also want to say one other thing, which is that
Your name, too, wouldn't you?
I'm sorry, Elizabeth Byers.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
We don't yet know the effects of not having mental health services on the Oregon Health Plan. I think we're beginning to see more and more people are losing access to their homes. They're living on the streets. More people are committing suicide. We don't yet know the cost of the Oregon Health Plan without mental health services. Thank you.
Thank you. Nina Stratton, I'm not sure that everyone is here. I'm going by the list from our last meeting. Chris Girard, David McCabe, Patrick Pine,
Mr. Chair, just yes. By way of information, I had the folks check on suicide, and the suicide rate has not increased over what it normally is running. Sure.
Okay. Patrick.
Yes.
Welcome.
Hi, I'm Patrick Pine. Thank you, Chair Marisette, members of the committee. I'm Corporate Benefits Manager for ESCO Corporation. My testimony this afternoon's intended to indicate some concerns we have with effectively achieving what we think are the positive intentions of Senate Bill 1 with or without the proposed amendments. My remarks will focus on a couple of key areas only, and I'm more as a resource, I think, to give you some insight from my experience. Quick background might be in order. ESCO Corporation employs about 600 persons at our Portland facilities. We also employ a few hundred people in California, which does have a form of mental health parity. We employ over 200 persons in Mississippi, about another 100 in Kentucky, another 100 plus in Arizona, and we have smaller numbers of employees in other locations and states. We provide a variety of medical and dental benefits to these employees in each location using a variety of different plan providers. We are currently fully insured, but in the recent past we have provided some of our benefits on a self-insured basis. As a result of our multi-state operations, we do deal with the different mandates in different states. For instance, in California, we have a form of mental health parity somewhat similar to the proposal in SB 1. But in Colorado, for instance, we don't have that mandate, but we do have a mandate to provide durable medical equipment to diabetics, which is a mandate we have in no other state. In Oregon, we currently provide three options to our employees for medical insurance: a plan through what is known as a multi-employer trust, a plan through PacifiCare, and a plan through Kaiser Permanente. Currently, about 50% of our employees are electing the multi-employer trust plan. The balance elect either Kaiser or PacifiCare. The multi-employer trust plan is an indemnity-type plan, one where you can go to any doctor, and after meeting a deductible, you will have, generally speaking, 80% or more of the remaining bill paid. This plan, however, is not subject to any state benefit mandates such as those proposed in Senate Bill 1, because state regulation of benefits through vehicles other than insurance is preempted by federal statutes and regulations known as ERISA. The board of the multi-employer trust plan is composed of managers or employee representatives, including some union representatives, of the trust member companies, and it has considered the option frequently of paying for mental health benefits and has chosen to date not to add these benefits based on the estimated additional costs as determined by their independent actuary. Therefore, even if Senate Bill 1 were in effect, more than 50% of our Oregon employees would not be reimbursed for any of the costs that would be covered by Senate Bill 1 because of the preemption. On the other hand, for the roughly one-third of the workforce enrolled in a Kaiser plan, the current plan does offer some of the and many of the benefits which would be required by Senate Bill 1. For the balance who are currently covered by a plan offered by PacifiCare, presumably SB 1 benefits would be mandated, and those people choosing PacifiCare would receive those benefits. While we do mandate that our Oregon employees must enroll in a company-sponsored medical plan as required by our multi-employer trust, we are seeing more employees drop coverage on their spouses and dependents in order to keep their perceived direct costs down. We are also seeing a number of employees who are electing the lowest cost plan, which in our case is a multi-employer trust. At other employers who do allow their employees to waive company-sponsored coverage, some of the SB 1 mandates would not reach that population. Many employers in Oregon do sponsor plans that are self-insured. Generally speaking, the self-insured plans are exempted from state regulation by the federal ERISA statutes. So if Senate Bill 1 were in effect, there is no assurance that any of these benefits would become available to any employees who have a self-insured plan unless the employer is willing to provide these benefits on a voluntary basis. I would say, based on everything I know, most people under current market conditions would be unlikely to add such benefits. It is my understanding SB 1 provisions would not apply to the Oregon Health Plan, Medicare, the VA system, nor individual insured plans or the uninsured population. Therefore, I do want to make clear, Senate Bill 1 would apply only to a minority of the working population and a small share of the total populace, only those who have fully insured plans that are not subject to the federal preemption. While some proponents of mental health parity have contended that the total cost of health care might fall if parity existed, I think it's fair to say that presumption is largely based on the presumption that these benefits are going to be available to a large segment of the population. In fact, we do have experience, a limited experience in California, and our experience to date in California is that the version of parity down there has added at least 1% to the monthly premium, depending on the plan and the group, maybe as much as 5% at current levels. However, in the first year of implementation in 1999, there was a more dramatic increase on California insured plan premiums, which I would say ranged from about 5 to 15% in the first year. To date, I'd like to tell you we've seen evidence of an improvement, but to date we cannot tell you that we've seen a reduction in our costs in California. Now, while a 1% incremental cost addition does not sound like much, if you look at a monthly premium for a family, which I think typically will be $700 a month or more these days, and you look at those premiums are rising at somewhere north of 15% annually, every 1% increment of cost does become crucial to the consideration of employers and employees alike. Presently, we have been forced to alter benefits in numerous ways, and I think lots of other employers will tell you the same thing. In the last 3 years, we have increased copays, deductibles, we've excluded various items from reimbursements, just in order to hold the annual rate of increase somewhere south of 20%. Many smaller employers have had to drop coverage altogether, they've switched to self-insurance, or they've made other distasteful trade-offs, such as cutting benefits for things like prescription drugs. The point I guess I'm making is that each incremental cost addition does have the effect of some further loss of coverage and or a reduction in a non-mandated benefit for some significant number of people. Now, we have been seeing a huge interest nationally and regionally in what are known as association plans, which would allow a group of employers to collectively acquire insurance. A major reason for that interest, I believe, is that the imposition of mandates on a state-by-state basis makes it difficult to maintain an economically viable package of benefits, and most association plans would qualify for the federal preemption. Many companies in our industry have been seeking that sort of arrangement out of a frustration with the recent rapid rise in costs for typical group plans. While there are many controversies surrounding this area that I won't go into this afternoon, it is largely driven by that frustration with plans that do have to provide multiple mandates and the associated costs with those multiple mandates. Now, I think it's fair to say that employers do not want to make these difficult decisions, nor do we inherently oppose the provision of good benefits for employees and their dependents. At ESCO, for instance, we spend millions of dollars per year on medical benefits, and our employees contribute significant amounts as well. Generally speaking, we're funding more than 75% of the costs of medical, dental, vision, and other related benefits for employees and their families. Those employees cannot acquire equivalent benefits in the individual market at a lower cost. As a personal note, I do have two nephews that deal with the problems associated with mental health care. So I know firsthand, very painfully, about the financial and emotional challenges that are involved. One happens to be in a family that has been very fortunate. They have an insured group plan that does have comparable mental health and substance abuse type benefits to those proposed in Senate Bill 1, and that greatly eases the financial burden on that relative's family of mine. The other nephew, however, happens to be in a family which has been left to personally finance most of the care for him because, coincidentally, they have a self-insured plan that does not provide those benefits. However, I would ask you to step back a little. There's nothing in Senate Bill 1 that will change that difference. One of my nephews will get those benefits, the other will not, and Senate Bill 1 would not change that. Frankly, we do see many of our employees, if given a choice, opting for the plan which does have the lowest perceived direct cost to them in terms of their contributions. Currently, that's the multi-employer trust plan, which does not offer the benefits envisioned in Senate Bill 1, and according to their staff, they do not think that they would offer them even if SB 1 were passed on a voluntary basis. It is important to note that this particular trust plan has existed for over 40 years. Our organization has been an active member of that trust for that 40-year period, so it was not created originally to avoid mandates, and that was not its purpose. What we do resist is the implementation of mandates that only apply to those who happen to be receiving fully insured group medical plan benefits through state-regulated insurers. For a multi-state employer like ours, the proliferation of mandates on a state-by-state basis can be problematic administratively, but more importantly, it does create some employee relations problems. I'll give you just a couple of quick examples and then I'll close. For instance, we do have an employee who's been working in Portland, and she has been enrolled in a Kaiser plan. She recently had to transfer down to our Arizona facility. She actually wanted to go down there. But we do not offer a Kaiser option. It's not available in the Phoenix area market, nor does it have the same mandated benefits as we offer here in Oregon. So she was very confused, and she called me a little while ago, says, I don't get it. I'm still working for the same employer. All I did is change locations, but all my benefits are entirely different in many respects because of that. Another problem that different state mandates creates is it does create some conflicting demands from employees depending on the part of the country that they may have come from. In the recent past, I encountered a new hire who came from Massachusetts. Massachusetts happens to have mandatory infertility treatment benefits. She was very upset when she found out that our plans do not offer any of those benefits and that they weren't mandated, and she was very upset that they weren't mandated in Oregon. Similarly, we have an employee and a spouse in Colorado as just one last example. Both suffer from diabetes, and they obtain a number of items in Colorado at a pretty low cost compared to anywhere else in the country because of California's mandate for durable medical equipment for diabetics. Therefore, they have been totally unwilling to move to any other location outside of Colorado just because of that benefit, even if we were to give them a substantial pay increase. I do not want you to construe this testimony to reflect that we are insensitive at all to the needs of our employees and their dependents, nor are we insensitive to the needs in the greater community. Rather, we find that mandates that only apply to selective groups do make it harder for us to provide equitable, comprehensive, and consistent benefits to all of our employees without forcing the curtailment of other non-mandated benefits. It is somewhat analogous, I think, to the extremely difficult choice that you and your fellow legislators struggle with every day, which is to meet the enormous competing demands for numerous legitimate needs while working with limited financial resources. And like you, each decision to fund one of those items will inevitably mean that some other competing demand can't be met. Thank you.
Thank you. Question?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
You mentioned three different policies here in the Portland area. Has the trust costs gone up in comparison to the other policies?
Yes, definitely. Depending on which year you're talking about, sometimes it rises faster, sometimes a little bit less. All the costs are going up for all the plans. I can't say that I notice a significant difference. I will say the trust plan, though, has maintained a cost competitive advantage for many years. That difference is somewhat narrowing recently, but they still have a significant advantage over the other options that we have available.
Do the other options, as they increase, have more people going down to the trust plan?
Yes, definitely.
So you would anticipate if this cost of other plans to go up that you would also then get another?
That would be for those, unless you have a compelling need that prohibits that. But for a lot of the average employee, they're gonna base it on their perceived costs. Now, that's not always in their best interest, I guess I'd say it that way, but that's how people make those decisions.
Thank you.
Mr. Ryan, did you have written testimony to provide to the committee?
You do have copies?
Yeah, I can provide you a copy.
Okay, if you would, please. Thank you. Lisa Tressel. Ellen Drake. Eileen, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Chair Morissette and committee members. My name is Eileen Drake. I'm Vice President of Human Resources and Legal Affairs for PCC Structurals. PCC Structurals is a division of Precision Cast Parts Corp. And like Mr. Pine, I am not here to oppose SB 1, but simply to ask that as you continue your deliberations, you take into consideration some of the impact that this will have on Oregon employers. And like Mr. Pine also, I'd like to use our company as an example of some of these factors. We provide medical, vision, and dental benefits for over 1,900 employees in the greater Portland metropolitan area. 1,500 of those employees are hourly employees. Currently, we pay over 80% of the premium costs for these medical benefits. On June 1st of this year, the cost of providing these benefits for our employees will increase by $2.2 million. That's not the total benefit cost. That's the increase that our insurance companies are presenting us with this year. That's over $1,100 more per employee per year to provide medical, vision, and dental benefits. According to our insurers, SB 1 would increase our cost by another $175,000 to $225,000 a year. I'm sorry, but I'm very skeptical of the representations made by Dr. Pollack that there would be no increase in our costs. First of all, the double-digit increases in medical benefit costs are of recent vintage. They go back only a couple of years, but they are projected to continue for the foreseeable future. Any studies that would be available now as to the impact of mental health parity on health premiums would be old data, out of date, dating back to years when the overall increase in health benefit costs was in the 3 and 4% range. We don't know what impact this would have on us other than the assurance of our insurance companies who set the rates with virtually no leverage for us to negotiate over those rates that they would increase our costs by 1.5% to 2%. While we would pay most of this extra cost, our employees would have to pick up some of the cost. And by way of illustration, we have three different plans, Kaiser and two Blue Cross plans, available for all of our employees. It doesn't make a difference whether you're hourly or salaried. You have the option to choose any one of those plans. One of those plans is our lower cost plan, and we cover the entire cost of the employee only portion of the premium, which it will be $239 a month on June 1st. Employees pay $40 or $70 a month under that plan, depending upon whether they have family coverage or just employee plus one. With our other two plans, the cost for employees would range from $30 a month up to a high of $270 a month for family coverage under one of our plans. That's the employee's portion of the premium. Our portion of those premiums range from $252 a month to $628 a month for the employees. To put it in another perspective, for our hourly employees, we currently spend over $15,000 a year on benefits, medical benefits, LTD and STD, and pension benefits. $15,000 per employee per year. We have an average hourly wage of $16.62. This means that for every $1 we pay in wages to an hourly employee, we spend 44 cents on benefits. We already provide substantial mental health and chemical dependency benefits. And I want to say, you know, again, we are very sympathetic to the underlying concerns on this bill. We, too, have employees who have significant mental health problems and chemical dependency problems. Chemical dependency problems are a major concern to us because of the safety implications for somebody coming to work under the influence of alcohol or drugs. Mental health conditions are a significant concern for us. We have employees for whom a full day at work is the exception, not the rule, because of mental health problems. So we do have concerns that there be adequate treatment available, that there be resources available for the employees. But at this point in time, We are in industries that are still reeling from the effects of September 11th and the Enron-related events. We happen to be in the aerospace and the power generation industries. And while some businesses today may be able to raise prices to cover increased costs, we face customers that are asking us to decrease our prices. The $2.2 million increase that we face this year in increased medical benefit costs, if you were to translate that into employee productivity, would mean that our employee productivity would have to increase by 5.7 points. So, for example, if today our employees are 90% productive in their direct labor versus their indirect time in the workplace, that would have to increase to 95.7% in order for us to cover the increased benefit cost. So what we're faced with, if this bill passes as it's currently written, is that we will have to go back to our benefit plans and look at redesigning our benefit programs and changing our coverage levels in order to be able to balance off the increased costs through internal plan changes. I don't believe that's what the supporters of SB 1 had in mind, that we would lower other medical benefits in order to pay for the increased costs that are bound to come through this bill. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell with Associated Oregon Industries, and we are here today in opposition to Senate Bill 1. And you've heard from some of our members, and we've presented some other testimony to you. It's not that we oppose benefits. In fact, our members, as you've heard, are struggling to provide benefits. Our concern lies in the fact that the private health care, private insurance market for health care is in as big a crisis as the Oregon Health Plan is. And there's a variety of reasons for that, but consistently what we're seeing amongst Oregon employers is how they're responding to these increases in health insurance. And as you've heard from several other presenters, one thing they look at when the cost of the insurance goes up is that benefit design changes. And those can relate to eliminating a benefit. For example, on a lot of plans, prescription drugs are considered a rider. So eliminating a benefit plan or increasing deductibles or in some way increasing the cost share of the employees. Costs for family health insurance in the small group market around Oregon have ranged from a low of $477 in Region 3, which is Marion and Polk counties, up to a high of $1,289 in Region 7, which is Douglas, Jackson, and Josephine County. And that, Mr. Chair and committee members, is based on 2002 data off the insurance webpage. Senate Bill 1 would only apply to those Oregonians who are covered under a group health insurance program. And we have seen in the last, based on the data that the insurance division collects, that we've seen a significant number of people who are no longer subject to the group insurance. And they are either going into self-insured plans. Larger employers can self-insure, and you heard a little bit just a few moments ago about how the mandates don't impact self-insureds or some Taft-Hartley trust, and or coverage is being completely dropped. The Oregonian last week, I picked up the paper twice last week. It was Wednesday and Friday. And the two times I grabbed the paper, there was over 1,200 jobs that were being cut on manufacturing wage jobs that were being cut. So we're still seeing decline in the economy. And as Mr. Pine mentioned, the Federal Association Health Plan proposal at the being looked at Congress would not be subject to the mandates. So that would be a benefit plan design that this bill, should it pass, would not apply to. And I think that it's being considered in part because of the cost of health insurance in this country, not just in Oregon. The other thing is when you look at mandates, and they are all well-intended, and we don't question that, but The money that you would save by implementing a mandate is only available to the people that have the condition. For everybody else, it's a cost increase. And I'm not sure if you spread it out across, you know, the group health insurance market, that if the, that the increase equates to the amount of the savings. So again, we empathize with the proponents and we understand their passion. But we are very concerned that if we pass any more mandates when we're looking at 15% to 18% premium increases, if the Oregon legislature does nothing but maintain the status quo, any increase could be enough that will be the straw on some employer that breaks their back where they will no longer be able to provide the benefit. And our desire is to increase the number of insured, not decrease it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I have a question for Ms. Trussell. You just stated in your testimony that mandates only affect that small portion of the population that have the condition. Well, I might agree with you on some conditions. Would you not agree with the testimony that we've heard tonight that one in four families are impacted by mental health issues, and also by Dr. Pollack, whom I apologize, I called him Mr. Pollack a while ago, that the Surgeon General has confirmed that 18 to 20% of the population is affected by a mental disorder. Would you dispute those two?
No, I wouldn't dispute those. Oh, could I add something? I forgot. One of our members was unable to make it, Kevin McCartan, and he asked that we present his testimony.
Okay. Did you?
Well, Mr. Chair, I was just making a point that mental illness does affect a substantial part of the population, so I guess I would disagree with the conclusions by the witness, but thank you.
Thank you. Todd York and Peggy Annette, please. Todd, Peggy. Oh, goodness.
Do you want me to get started? Senator Morissette, members of the committee, I apologize. I was asked a pinch hit for a colleague of mine, so I don't have any prepared materials.
Yes.
My name is Todd York. I'm an insurance agent here in town. I'm an independent agent. I work on behalf of about 65 small to medium employers and specialize in the area of health insurance benefits. I feel really torn here because I've worked in the mental health field when I was much younger, and my wife is a mental health professional, and I believe very strongly in mental health benefits, and I do believe that their value is undeniable. However, I'm also here to voice the concern of employers. The people that I'm working with are struggling to pay escalating health insurance premiums. My average rate increase that I'm delivering to my groups is between 15 and 20%. A year ago, that was probably 20 to 25%, and I agree with other people that have testified that we don't see a lot of light at the end of the tunnel at this point. But I sure like the idea of 15 to 20 versus 20 to 25%. And I think the timing of Senate Bill 1 is awful. It's just inopportune time to add anything that's going to escalate the cost of health care right now. What's happening with the smaller employers, both of the people that have testified from employers so far, they pay the majority of the premium. One of them, I believe, was 75%. One was 85%. With these smaller groups, the smallest group I have actually just has one employee enrolled. I've got groups up to about 250 employees. And the most common arrangement we're seeing as far as what employers contribute towards those premiums is they'll pay 100% of what the single employee's premium is. And I'd say that's going to be in the range of $250. And if employees want to cover their dependents, they bear the whole cost of that. And what I'm seeing right now is people are not covering their dependents, can't. Especially when we're talking about small hourly wages. I think what I'm seeing out there is what's already been mentioned. Deductibles are being increased, benefits are being reduced. Some of that cost shift is going to be picked up by employers. It's undeniable that this is going to be an added cost. I think it's going to be borne by employers, and I think at this point, my employers are getting to the point where they can't pay anymore. The business climate out there is slow to ugly, and so they're shifting that cost to the employees. And when there's a $250 a month single premium, usually the family premium is going to be in the realm of three times that, $750. So if you have an employer that's paying that single rate, it's costing them $500 a month to cover their families. So a lot of them are dropping coverage. And every additional cost is going to exacerbate that problem. The mental health benefit that we have today is a limited benefit. Just to refresh people's minds, it amounts to about 14 days inpatient care per 24-month period. Outpatient, depending on the company, 26 to 28 outpatient encounters or visits, however they want to state it, per 24-month period. If you have a serious mental health problem, yes, you will go through that. But a limited benefit I see is way preferable to forcing people out of the market altogether. I'm out there fighting every day to try and keep healthcare affordable for my clients, and it feels like a losing battle. This will make it worse. And anything that increases premium costs at this time is going to hurt the market. I also asked this of Peter Courtney directly. I don't see how the legislature can strip mental health benefits from the Oregon Health Plan. I mean, that was a done deal very quickly, almost without a whimper, and then turn around to my employers and say, not only do you have to have mental health benefits, but you have to increase them, and increase them with no limit. There's a lot of middle ground there that I don't think has been explored. Like I said, basically, I'd love to see mental health parity. I just don't think we can afford it, and I know my employers can't afford it.
I have a question, Mr.
Yes.
Chair. Mr. York, that's an interesting comment you just made. What was the answer by Senator Courtney?
Peter didn't have a lot to say about that one. He didn't really respond. In fact, actually, I made the appointment to go see him before I had gotten a copy of the bill. And the first thing I talked to him about was Senate Bill 1. And he didn't respond to me. And later I asked him if he had any agenda items of his own, because I was having a hard time drawing him out. He said, no, he's president of the Senate, and, you know, it was just kind of the Senate's agenda. And the next day I got a copy of the bill and found out he co-sponsored it.
We're going to have to move.
Yep.
We have 45 minutes, and we have a ton of people who want to testify.
That's all I had to say. Are there any other questions?
Thank you.
Peggy.
Peggy, do you have a lot of testimony?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Peggy Annett, and I represent the Health Insurance Association of America, and no, I'm not going to read my testimony. I am going to, there's quite a bit of information in there, and I provided it as background information for you. The other thing that I handed you was a copy of a transcript of the testimony that the actuary who did the actuarial analysis for the advocates presented to a joint interim Human Resources Committee in 1998, and Senator Fisher chaired that committee. I think you'll find that information interesting because he outlines a lot of the assumptions, and some of my comments are going to focus on Mr. Bachman's comments as well as the actuarial analysis that he did for the advocates. But first, what I would like to say, and you've heard a lot of that this evening from the employer and the agent community, that employers and insurers are looking at a situation in terms of rising health insurance costs that I don't think there's a good understanding of. It's extremely difficult to deal with this. My recommendation on Senate Bill 1 would be to do similarly to what is having to be done in the Oregon Health Plan, and that is focus the bill on those areas where we know that we have issues that need to be addressed. And I specifically think that area has to do with benefits provided to children with serious mental illness. That's been an issue for a long time. In fact, it was an issue when I first started talking about this in 1987. Generally, my comments fall into the cost category and the assumptions related to managed care. The discussions about the increases associated with this mandate being 1.2% are not quite... doesn't tell the full story in terms of what was included in the actuarial analysis. That 1.2% premium increase is actually only 40% of the full premium increase anticipated by employers. The increase was actually estimated to be more like 3%. And the assumption was that the employer would actually deal with 40% of the cost in terms of absorbing it by making changes that you've heard about before, increasing deductibles, looking for an alternative plan that might have a lesser rate, lowering wage increases, and reducing other benefits. The 60% that is also discussed in there actually relates to plan design changes versus what the employer might pick up. The other assumption that is key, so what I'm saying is that this 1.2% increase that is projected is actually a 3% increase, which is a composite, and he also included in his analysis a range of rate increases that range from 7% down to this a lower number. The other assumption that is key that the actuary made was that the employer only picks up 50% of the premium cost. So therefore, in terms of the benefits that employer provides, then the employee himself or herself is going to have to pick up 50%, as I said, of those costs. What is happening then, as you've heard about more employers going self-insured or considering it, this burden primarily falls on the small employer group. In Oregon right now, we only have approximately 240,000 covered lives that are in the small group market, which is where this is going to hit the most. And you've heard about the rate increases that these people are looking at. The other issue that relates to this, though, is that what is happening is that employers, as you've heard, are capping their premiums. And I looked at some data provided through the Oregon School Boards Association 2002-2003 Teacher Salary and Benefits Survey. In 1998, when this actuarial report was done, 41% of school districts had caps. Presently, the number is 88.4%. The issue is that cost increases with these kinds of caps are going directly to the covered population. When I looked at the amount of out-of-pocket cost that were in place in the school districts, only 17 districts had no cap, and only 14 had monthly caps of less than $50. The highest monthly out-of-pocket contribution for an employee per month was $683 a month. Now, that was an anomaly, but monthly contributions on the part of the employees or the teachers were commonly in the $100 to $200 a month range. This is significant in that there was a study done in the late 90s by the AFL-CIO, and their conclusion was that the largest reason that individuals were going to lose employer-provided coverage was due to the fact that the employees would not be able to make their premium contributions. To try and put this into perspective, what this 1.2% represents dollar-wise, I went to an insurance division report and looked at a report that they do for the 25 largest health insurers in Oregon. And I did some adjustments, and this is an imprecise calculation. But in 2000, the premiums from the 25 largest health insurers were somewhere in the area of $4.6 billion. A 1.2% increase, this number being taken from the actuarial report as to what the employers would pick up, that translates into $48 million. That is not what even the report estimated would be the full impact of this. This almost doubles, actually it's about a 50% increase, I should say, in the total amount of money that's presently spent on mental health and chemical dependency benefits. Another key assumption in here is that managed care is going to control cost. As many of you know, particularly those who are in the rural parts of the state, that managed care is no longer an option. In addition to that, we also know that there has been an evolution away from managed care because of the backlash during the 1980s. Again, this is an issue that even the actuarial report noted, in that the comment was made that there was an even smaller portion of small employers that are enrolled in managed care plans. Again, on the issue of what is happening with regard to the utilization of mental health services, last summer a group of insurers attempted to collect some data to see what actually was happening in Oregon regarding the utilization of services. Between 1998 and 2001, approximately $248 million were spent on these services. In 2001, the last year for which we had data, the amount was $69 million. The largest portion of those costs go towards mental health services, which is about 82%. Very few people reach their benefit limits, and this goes to the issue of targeting any potential increase. Less than 5% of the total insureds among the four carriers that utilize their mental health benefits and substance abuse benefits reach their maximums. 5% utilize the services of the total number of lives, and of those, less than 2% reach their benefit maximums. And I should also point out that these costs do not include prescription drugs, because prescription drugs are included in a different component of the benefit policies. These costs are significant. I only was able to get data from one carrier, and this one particular carrier spent $12 million for drugs in 2001. In the first 6 months of 2002, they had spent $13.9 million on antidepressant and antipsychotic drugs. Going to the question as to who would be affected by this, we've talked about the self-insureds. The other issue that comes up relates to who would move from a public program or who falls into a public program. The actuary actually addressed this, and his comments were that essentially you are not going to see very much movement at all from the public program into a private program. Where he did see the possibility of an impact on public sector programs was particularly in the area of those individuals, and he identified children, who reached their benefit limits. Again, this is the area that I think needs to be addressed in terms of revising mental health benefits. There's an interesting phenomena, too, that I would point out when you get into the discussion of managed care. When people talk about what the costs are associated with mental health parity, they always talk about the reliance on managed care, greater utilization of outpatient services and drugs versus the need for inpatient. If you get into the discussion of quality of care, though, the discussion changes for the need for more inpatient services and less managed care, to be perfectly honest. I would also be the first to acknowledge that I think Oregon is in need of an improved set of resources to treat children with mental health services or mental health conditions. I think a number of you are aware of that situation, that we do not have adequate facilities in the state. In summary, what I would say is that I think Senate Bill 1, as I've mentioned, should focus on the populations that warrant additional service. We already know that mental health and substance abuse services are the most expensive services required to be offered by in Oregon. And we also know that people are losing their coverage due to premium increases and their inability to make their premium contributions. I think we must be concerned about both, and I think we need to take a look at private employer-provided coverage in the same light that we've taken a look at the Oregon Health Plan and figure out how we can stabilize the coverage and target on those special needs areas that warrant some change. Thank you. And since I already gave you so much paper, I will provide staff a copy of the AFL-CIO report that deals specifically with the impact of the changing patterns of employee requirements towards premium contributions.
Thanks. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I just want to thank Ms. Annett. She always does her research and provides us with good information, even though we don't always agree with it.
Thank you. Thank you, Peggy. Thank you. Okay, Barney Spade is not here. Kate Smith, Marianne Bornholder, Jan Lacey. Oh, okay. I'm going to. Yes, Jan. Now, we're running out of time, and I don't want to cut people off, but you have to be brief. And if you have written testimony, please, if you could tell us about it briefly, that would be great, because I would like us to be finished.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mary Anna Bornholt. I'm Vice Chair of the Governor's Commission on Senior Services Legislative Committee. I'm also retired from private practice as a mental health professional. I'm here to express the strong support of the Commission for Senate Bill 1 as written. It's a good bill, and last week you received our favorable testimony on that subject. The strength of the bill is that it seeks the premises that the whole person is to be treated, not just symptoms. I do want, however, to respond to the Dash 2 amendments which were presented. One issue that has come up is we've heard about how prevalent mental illness is and substance abuse, as well as the likelihood that these conditions co-occur with mental conditions. There has been mention of best practices and evidence-based treatments, but very little has been presented in this arena as to what these treatments actually are. And in part, this is due to the fact that research and innovation are in process. This is a rapidly evolving field with the fruits of ongoing research and experiment yet to come. And this is one reason why we object to the treatment exclusions which were specified in the Dash 2 amendments. Senate Bill 1 removed dollar amount caps, but the Dash 2 amendments replaced them with mandated treatment exclusions. These were formulated by the insurance companies and providers who would be regulated should the bill pass. Consumers and mental health advocates did not participate in this formulation of what mental health and substance abuse treatment should or could be.
So the amendments are self-serving by the industry to regulate the terms on which it will be regulated. As stated, it seems to us that the Dash 2 amendments intrude the insurance company between the physician and his patient. Medical necessity should be determined by the practitioner. Much has been made of the desirability of early treatment and intervention on behalf of children with emotional illness. I would like to speak to you on behalf of another vulnerable group with mental health and addictions consumer issues, the elderly. Trauma from the past and unresolved personal issues can and do precipitate chronic depression, somatic symptoms, and even suicide in later life. And as with children, treatment works, so it works with the elders. Children are more likely to possess a natural support system, family, schools, whereas seniors suffer increasing loss. In fact, loss is endemic to old age, and relatively isolated lifestyles make elders vulnerable. We were concerned that the Department of Human Resources was excluded in the Dash 2 amendments in the rulemaking and administrative process. Current trends in state agency administration foster collaborative partnerships. If DHS was at the table, that would better ensure the active presence of consumers and mental health advocates in the process. I won't get into the argument of costs. I am a statistician, but I think you've heard enough numbers today. Just don't mess up a good bill. We respectfully urge you to reject the Dash 2 amendments, ignore the negative comments, and pass out Senate bill as written to the full Senate with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
My name is Jan Lacey. I am a member of the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill in Multnomah County. And the reason for that is that I have a son who had the onset of schizophrenia at the age of 16. And that was about 3 years ago. The written testimony I'm putting in front of you is the first page is basically about the crisis and my testament upon the what the issue of rights and what I feel is we are lacking in civil liberties if we don't pass parity in insurance, because I have experienced it. And so rather than reading that, I'll just summarize that for you, because I know we're tight for time. In the summer of 1999, my son had the onset of schizophrenia. Up until that point, he had been a champion wrestler at his high school, at Wilson High School. He had been in a lead in all of the plays. He had been diagnosed as attention deficit hyperactivity. These children love to be physically engaged. They're very bright and creative. But at the age of 16 that summer, we saw him quickly spiral. And he began to think of us as aliens and told us we were aliens. And he lived in fear night and day. He could not sleep at night. We quickly scrambled to find a psychiatrist who would see him. Everyone said, "I don't have 1 minute available for you. It'll be 2 months out." We were in crisis. My son confessed to a relative that he would kill himself if he could not get help, if he was to live this way the rest of his life. We finally got a doctor who understood the crisis, brought him in on Monday, started him on antipsychotics, and told us to come back Friday. We did. He had indicated on Monday that we might have to be in the that Sean might have to go to the hospital. When we went on Friday, he told us that he was calling St. Vincent's and that he was trying to get him a bed there. We were lucky. There was a bed. But my husband turned to me and said, we can't afford to put him in the hospital. And my question, of course, was to him, we can't afford not to. And he said, our insurance covers 2 days. Our insurance covered 2 days. Our doctor was telling us that he needed to be there for at least 2 weeks. The beginning of school was starting. We could only keep our son there for 5 days because we were in such anxiety over the medical costs. The hospital did everything that they could to cram in the CAT scans, the evaluations, the EEGs. It was a discrimination I wasn't prepared for. The last thing in the world you want to hear is that your child is being diagnosed with schizophrenia. What does that mean? Well, I tell you what the medical community says. They say it's the most devastating disease that an individual can have. And so I was outraged when I realized that if my son had been in a car accident, if his health had been concerned for any other organ in his body, but his brain, but with the diagnosis of a brain disorder, and that's what we teach in Visions for Tomorrow, we do not call it mental health anymore, folks. Science has told us. We've got proof. You look at brain imaging. The brain is an organ that is being damaged by chemical imbalances, by hormone imbalances. We have got to stop looking at mental health as if it is something that we want to throw out with the dirty water. And that is what's happening. I sympathize with what's going on, and I think we need health reform. I don't know of anybody that doesn't. But we have got to start looking at the necessities of families and children who are going through this. I was out of work after that because I needed to stay home with my son. My husband eventually filed for bankruptcy. If you don't think this is financially affecting the businesses and families economically, then you're wrong, and you need the testimony that will substantiate that. So on the second page, what I've written for you is what I'm going to read, because when you find out you have a child with mental illness, you get into gear and you find out what the reality is, and I want you to know what the reality is. When you find out your child has a devastating disease such as schizophrenia, you learn everything you can about the disease and how you might help them, because the conditions are so misunderstood. You must also protect them and become an advocate in support and educate the public. As it turns out, you learn in your zeal that the brain is an organ like any other organ in the body. Biological and chemical changes inside the brain can cause damaging effects. Psychotic thought disorders have been called the most devastating of all medical diseases. I have devoted much of my time to learning about the chemistry and the way the chemistry of the brain works. I have learned how the overabundance or the lack of certain neurotransmitters damage the brain. I have learned how the chronic presence of some hormones, namely cortisol, the stress hormone, can damage the brain. Research into the science of the brain has been termed as the last frontier of humans on Earth. Discoveries are being made every day into the complicated organ. Right here in our home state, researchers from the Neuroscience Institute at OHU are receiving grants from NIH to study the disease of the brain and to provide hope for the care of hope for care providers and families in treating symptoms. The gains science has made in the last few years have allowed children to be treated with medications that can eliminate their psychotic thoughts, although there are some side effects that still remain. Don't keep Oregon in the dark ages. Recognize these illnesses as legitimate and honor the patients with the rights and the dignity that they deserve. To do otherwise is to continue to punish those who are afflicted and to keep injustice alive. I know that some insurance companies may offer you reasons for not creating parity. I will offer you this. A parent is like the lioness with her cubs, fighting to protect their lives in any way she or he can. We will continue to fight until there is justice, and we are talking about justice here. There is hope if there is appropriate treatment. There are fewer indigent adults if they are treated as children. Equality and justice are rights all people, and people are the rights of all people, and people come first, as our Constitution guarantees us. Not businesses. And again, I sympathize with the plight of businesses. But that is not what liberty and justice for all is spoken to when we pledge the allegiance. We're talking about people, and it is not fair to continue to discriminate those who have an illness concerned with the organ of the brain. And just as the last point I would like to make, let me remind you of other diseases and physical conditions associated with mental illness. 1 in 10 people with schizophrenia will commit suicide. Heart disease is twice as common among those with schizophrenia. Smoking is 3 times as high in those with schizophrenia. 1 out of 5 people with mental illness are addicted to drugs and alcohol. Diabetes is 2 to 4 times more common among people with mental illness. So don't burden people who are afflicted with this just because it's not economically a good idea. We're talking about discrimination and people's civil liberties here. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Eric Adberg, Dr. Bill Dahome, Linda Larson, Claire Cruz, okay. Dr.
My mom always said, never testify before a committee that might be hungry.
Oh, goodness.
I've been eating chocolate. Thank you, doctor.
I have a junk food bill. I wonder if this is okay to eat. An anti-junk food bill, I should say.
I can't tell you how pleased and appreciative that we are, and I say we because I think you've heard a great deal of eloquent testimony, a lot of it in favor of this bill, some of it raising important questions. Some of us have waited 8 years to have the opportunity to even hear this bill, the subject of this bill heard, and it really is a wonderful experience to be sitting here. Very much appreciate your continuing the hearing from the other day. My name is Dr. Bill Dalton. I'm here just as Bill Dalton this evening, not as a part of any particular group. I've been in community mental health and human services administration for 25 years, the bulk of that here in Oregon. I am moved by the testimony that we have heard from people who have experienced mental illness firsthand and in their family firsthand. I have my own stories to share. I don't think they're anywhere near as important as the ones you've already heard, so I would just like to skip those. What I would like to do is take a couple of minutes that are available to me to maybe try and focus on some of the issues and important issues and questions that have been raised in either opposition to this bill and what it's trying to accomplish, or at least ask you to consider potentially changing the bill and the provisions therein. I think one of the things that's most important, and I would like to emphasize right at the get-go, is that I don't think this bill and the supporters of this bill are asking you specifically to add any mandates or even add any benefits. What we're trying to do through the vehicle of Senate Bill 1 is to eliminate clear cases of discrimination in the way our health care is provided and insured in the state of Oregon. And it's interesting that this has served as such a magnet for people who are concerned about underfunded or unfunded mandates and the like. I've dealt with this my whole professional career. I've cut as many budgets as I've put together, and it's been a painful experience, and you all are experiencing even greater pain. But this is not an issue that should be looked at as what you're going to add. What you're taking away are those provisions that provide discriminatory behavior against one class of biologically based physical illnesses that happen to be labeled the mental illnesses. We certainly have raised a number of questions. We have ever since this whole idea came up about the cost of eliminating these discriminatory provisions that restrict the amount of care that can be provided to people that have been diagnosed with mental illness. And I think back from the time in 97 and 99, the times I first met with Senator Fisher to talk about this issue and do my own form of lobbying, if you will, we were dealing with a lot of hypotheses, and I think a lot of good questions were asked by a lot of good people about what are the costs going to be. Then we got into the era of the Bachman study that was referred to, the 98 Bachman study, that was such an important part of the effort in 99 to bring up parity legislation here in the state of Oregon. And again, what we had there were projections, if you will, and we heard some questions raised about those projections. I'm not a statistician. I have enough statistical background that I can raise some of the very same questions that were contained in the Bachman study, though I also applauded the fact that we finally had a study that went out on the limb and tried to project what it would cost to eliminate discriminatory provisions limiting mental health care. We are in the very good, very positive position now in the year 2003 not to have to deal with hypothesis, not to have to deal with projections, not to have to deal with just statistical efforts to understand. 38 states in the union have eliminated to some degree or all degrees the limitations on coverage for mental health, and we now have a database. And that database tells us that the changes in overall cost will range anywhere from potentially a small decrease in costs of providing care because of the impact on other physical illnesses when you start providing care to mental illnesses, all the way up to potentially an increase of a percentage or a percentage and a half. And none of those studies pretend to take into consideration the middle and long-term impact on the other institutions that are impacted by untreated mental illness. And those institutions are the ones that are tremendous drivers in the very budgets that you're going to have to try and balance this year as you have in other bienniums. We're talking about jails. We're talking about inpatient hospitals. We're talking about schools. We're talking about law enforcement. But we won't even come here and talk about those cost savings. We'll allude to them. But until we have hard data, we're only going to allude to them. But the hard data we have is based on the experience of other states where they have eliminated these discriminatory provisions. And those are something that you can rest on and hang your hats on as we talk about what the impact would be here in Oregon. Another issue that has been raised, interestingly, is that these provisions, if we provide the elimination of the discriminatory provisions, will impact not all of the people in the state of Oregon, because some aren't covered by insurance, some are covered by other plans, some come under the ERISA provisions of the national government. But yet, think of the value to the people that will be impacted positively by eliminating this discrimination. You've heard their stories. You've heard the stories of the parents. You'll hear some of the stories of the consumers. These people will be impacted positively. They will have an impact on our community. And I say the analogy is, if you have a Marine battalion under attack in Iraq and five of those Marines are killed, would you make the decision not to rescue the rest of the battalion simply because some of those people are casualties? No, I don't think we'd do that. I think we would go in and do our very best to serve the people that have the need, and we certainly have heard of the need. Another interesting part is, if we only have 2% of some other percent of the population that even exceeds the benefit limits, why would you use that as an argument against doing what Senate Bill 1 is trying to accomplish? What I would say is, heck, we're going to have a very minimal impact on the overall cost of health care in the state of Oregon if all we're dealing with is this tiny percentage of people that are going to run over the current benefit anyway. The last issue that I want to comment on is, let's not fall into the very sad and misleading trap of making mental illnesses and addictions the scapegoat for the rising cost in insurance premiums. Now, I've been down the block here and have received some very excellent care at Salem Hospital, but I'm always delighted by the beautiful condition of the waiting room and the new skyways that have been built and the new outpatient facilities that exist, and the fact that I can get my MRI at a whole variety of spin-off facilities that somehow don't fall under any of the health regulatory provisions that we have here in the state of Oregon. I would suggest that the rising cost of the premiums that you've heard about, ranging anywhere from 15% to 22%, to eliminate the lowest and highest of the testimony that you've heard, are not caused by mental health and addictions. In fact, people have even admitted at the worst case we may go up 3%, which isn't true. But even if you take that worst case scenario, a 3% increase in premiums is nowhere near accounting for the terrible pressure that our families and our industry, large and small, are honestly facing in this state. I served on the old HSAs in this state, and I saw what it was like to try and exercise regulatory control over the tremendously expanding cost of health care. And once we eliminated those, we eliminated probably your last source of true control over the escalating costs of health care. And it has precious little to do with mental health and mental illness, and it has an awful lot to do about what the American people think they would like to have in the way of physical health care. And I think we're going to have to take a hard look at some of those larger issues and maybe not focus so much of our time and energy on really what amounts to a very small part of the impact, and truly at this point something that, for the case of morality, if nothing else, needs to be done, and that is to eliminate discrimination. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you for the crackers, too. Jenny Davidson? Janine Delaney is not here. Don Spiegel? Ann Heath?
Okay. I'm Corinne Spiegel.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay, I have Don, but Corinne, did you want to testify?
Well,
yeah, somebody else is Bob tonight, Mr. Chair. So.
Well, it says...
Don came with me on Thursday.
Darlene Brandt? Okay. Edwin Corden. Is Edwin here? Okay. Kathy Larrabee? Okay, Kathy, would you come up toward the front, please? Wayne... Kiger, Wayne.
Okay.
Okay. We have about 7 minutes, so we're going to have to really move it.
If I may start, I'm Corinne Spiegel with Jewish Family and Child Services in Portland, where I work as an inclusion specialist. And the number one complaint we hear from our clients is that children, adolescents, and adults are not getting the good available treatment that they need because of lack of parity. I'd like to tell you, though, my last time being at a commission or a meeting like this was 13 years ago when I came to Salem to talk about another insurance issue. And at the time, in Oregon, children who were adopted were not required to be covered by insurance companies right away. And we laugh at that now because we had the laws changed despite the objections from insurance carriers and small businessmen at the time who thought it would be an overwhelming expense to include adopted children at the time that they were adopted. We got that law mandated in Oregon, and for some reason it didn't seem to have any impact at all on the effectiveness of insurance carriers or small business. And so I know that given good information, we can make good decisions together. I strongly suggest that we pass Senate Bill 1. On a personal note, my husband and I have four children, one of whom is a 19-year-old with obsessive-compulsive disorder, pervasive developmental disorders, anxiety disorders, and a number of other issues. In the last 10 years, he's had two hospitalizations. He's been placed in two residential facilities, including one out of state because there was not an available place for him here. And during that time, only when he was in residence did he get any kind of mental health coverage for his needed medication and treatment. During the same 10-year period, though, my husband had open-heart surgery. He had a bout with cancer, had a malignancy, and followed up with radiation. Every treatment that he needed for his body was covered. But while my son, with lots of mental health issues, was seeking the same needed treatment, none of his were covered by insurance at that time. I know that as a professional working in the community with other families, the best outcome is for those individuals who get the medications they need along with regular psychotherapy. And that we've been able to provide our child, even though our insurance company has not provided that for him right along. I think it's outrageous that insurance companies can pick which parts of the bodies they want to cover and which parts they don't. I would like to make a comparison to automotive insurers. We would not allow an automotive insurer to do business in Oregon if they provided collision insurance for every part of their vehicle except the engine. And I think it's very much the same issue with the brain. And I have submitted the testimony. I'll leave you to read that at another time, but I thank you for your careful consideration of this issue.
Okay. Thank you. Would you identify yourself, please?
Chairman Morissette, members of the committee, my name is Ed Condon. I'm with the Citizens Commission on Human Rights. I'm here to oppose the SB 1. The argument in favor is that mental illness and physical illness are the same, and that passing the bill will save patients and employees in the state of Oregon money. I assert that both propositions are false. Reason being that a lot of illnesses are actually manufactured by the APA. They're voted on and they're put into their diagnostic and statistical manual of psychiatry. This manual has gotten larger and larger over the course of years, and now will catalog almost any disorder. My attachment to my testimony supports the assertion that many mental disorders are manufactured illnesses and end up unjustly labeling patients. What I want to stress to the committee today is that a majority of mental illnesses have a physical component that is being virtually ignored by the mental health industry. Because the physical component is being ignored, an astounding statistical figure comes to light, and that is 40% to 80% of physical illnesses are being misdiagnosed as mental illnesses. And so our view is that the emphasis should be placed on better screening, more blood work, more examination to determine what physically is upsetting a person who has mental disorders. For instance, I'll give you an example. ADHD, there are a number of physical symptoms which can manifest as ADHD. Hypoglycemia, allergies, learning disability, visions, hearing problems, lead levels, spinal problems, toxic exposures, carbon monoxide poisoning, all these deficiencies in vitamins, sleeping disorders. Those can all manifest as ADHD. So the question is, the emphasis should be put on physical examination first before any mental prescription is given. Also, our commission works with patients whose mental health benefits have been abused. We work with getting their benefits rectified if there's errors in billing. We've run across areas of fraud in the hospitals and clinics. The chance of fraud happening because of additional benefits will only increase. I just want to remember, I want to just briefly want to tell you that the statistic that I'm putting forth today is 40 to 80% of physical illnesses are misdiagnosed as mental illnesses. Looking for the physical component and treating it first makes good sense. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the other members of the committee. I encourage you to read my attachments.
Good evening, Chair Morissette and members of the committee. My name is Sandy Bumpus. I am reading testimony on behalf of Kathy Larrabee and Wayne Kiggerel. And I'd also, if there's enough time, I'm going to be very brief. If enough time, I'd like to make a couple of comments
in
closing.
You're the last witness, and
we're already out of time. Okay. The letter I'm also submitting to you is written by the father. His name is Wayne Kiggerel. He starts off by saying, I am a father with a son diagnosed with a psychiatric illness, and I wish to share our personal experience in getting the essential treatment he required and the extreme challenges presented by inadequate private health insurance coverage. It is unjust for health insurance companies to provide minimum or no benefits for mental health illnesses while providing maximum benefits for other physical conditions. By labeling mental illness as mental and nervous disorders, health insurance companies wittingly make them sound less devastating, thus avoiding responsibility for necessary treatment. While a diseased liver, perhaps the result of alcohol abuse, may qualify for a $500,000 coverage, a diseased mind, as in the case of our child, only qualifies for $10,000. This is unfair and discriminatory, but it is the reality for our particular insurance company. When our son was 17, he was diagnosed with adolescent schizophrenia and became isolated, delusional, and suicidal, requiring psychiatric hospitalization costing over $1,000 per day. After 10 days and $10,000, our insurance company had already paid our son's lifetime maximum benefit. We were left to our own resources, and by no means would we consider stopping treatment, so we began to liquidate our limited assets to pay for his care. For our son, a bright, talented youth, it was a matter of life and death. His mind had betrayed him through no fault of his own. The weeks went by, and our bill reached $25,000. Options included deleting our savings and selling our home and property, which we did. We also decreased our workload in order to care for him and deal with the mental health system of care, which can be very, very confusing. Bankruptcy became a real possibility, and finally he was admitted to Oregon State Hospital in Salem in the adolescent residential care program at a cost of approximately $100,000 to taxpayers. Today, he is a full-time student at Portland State University with a 3.0 GPA. His remarkable literary and artistic skills have been expressed through his artwork, which has been part of a public exhibit and is scheduled for several more. We are incredibly proud of him for his courage and resiliency and very grateful for the medical treatment he has received. Of course, our health insurance does not provide benefits for the expensive medicine that is now necessary for his continued recovery, nor for any relapse for future treatment. But he is now 19 and on the Oregon Health Plan, and his medication is covered. He is also still on our private health insurance with its limited mental health benefits. Without our support as parents, his outlook would have been bleak. It took incredible effort to coordinate between and for him to find the resources that were out there. NAMI provided a crucial link and great support. Those without insurance and even those with insurance, because of the discriminatory bias against covering mental illnesses and insufficient benefits, provided a face a path that leads to, for many, to despair, isolation, and early death. And withholding coverage and treatment is regressive and costs the taxpayer much more later in dealing with the homeless and shattered lives that were once our children. With coverage and treatment, patients with psychiatric illnesses can lead productive, satisfying lives and contribute to our society. And I'll pass these around for your for your record. And I just want to add that I also am the parent of a son who is almost 20 years old, also diagnosed with schizophrenia, who has been sick since the age of 8, diagnosed with several disorders, one which at one point it was the neurological disorder that some of you may have heard of called Tourette syndrome. We were always told that that was a mental illness and that that would have to be taken out of his mental health benefits, which at that day was $2,000 for everything, including medications. And also my situation is that I was a single parent, so this lack of mental health parity has affected my family in the sense that we have had to stop treatment from time to time. So I'm going to close in asking you not to take away our hope. As someone mentioned earlier, it has been 8 years that we've been waiting for a bill like this to be heard, and we hope that you will make a decision to do the right thing. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. With that, I'll close the public hearing and open the work session.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I would move the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 1.
Okay, Senator Walker moves the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 1. Would you call the...
Well,
discussion.
I'm sorry. Any discussion?
Well, I'd like to speak to my motion, Mr.
Speak
Chair.
To your motion.
We had significant testimony on April 3rd by John Powell and Lynn Hagan, who walked us through the Dash 2 amendments. So I think we're all pretty familiar with those amendments. And I think while some would like us to have the original bill, I think this is a good compromise.
Okay. Further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Senator Bennis,
Senator Shields, aye. Senator Starr, aye. Senator Walker,
aye.
Senator
Fisher,
aye.
Senator Morsack,
aye.
Aye.
Yes, Senator Walker.
Dash 2
amendments been approved.
And Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 1 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Discussion, comments. I would like to say that this has been, I think, a fair hearing. We heard a lot of comments, pro and con. We gathered a lot of material, very compelling stories, very, I think, persuasive arguments in opposition, a lot of good data. I support the bill. I support the concept. I think mental illness is an insidious, hidden disease at times, very devastating. I don't think it should be separated from any other kind of illness. I think that we need to try to do the right thing, the parity. I don't know where this bill is going to go. I hope it will pass. But I appreciate all of you who came twice in some cases and have been willing to sit through the 4 hours plus of testimony. And so I do thank you for being here. No other comments? Would you please?
Mr. Chair, I would like to echo those comments that you made. We had some good testimony on both sides, but I'm just compelled over and over again by the testimony that we need to bring mental health illnesses out of the closet and stop discriminating against them. I was just amazed by the testimony this evening
that mental health and addiction disorders are discriminated against, and it's time that we stop doing that. I think I couldn't say it any better than the witnesses who testified today or on the third.
Okay. Senator Shields.
Yeah, I've been listening to the testimony on television as I was doing some other work this evening. I would like to remind us that we're not totally pioneers here. Many other states have already done what we're doing. Thank you.
Other comments? Would you call the roll, please?
Senator Meadows. Senator Shields.
Aye.
Senator Starr.
Aye.
Senator Wallace.
Aye.
Senator Fisher.
No.
Senator Marsden.
Aye. Okay, we do have a majority vote, and so I will. The bill has passed out of committee to the floor of the Senate. And with that, I will. Well, the carriers will be Senator Hannon and Senator Gordley will be the carriers. Okay, and with that, I will close. Adjourned the meeting. Thank you very much.